From the Los Angeles Times, this is Can't Stop Watching, your TV faves on their TV faves. I'm your host, Yvonne Villarreal. On today's episode, we can't stop watching Michael Douglas. You've seen him in countless movies and TV shows over the years. Now, he's playing acting coach Sandy Kominsky on The Kominsky Method.
It's fun. I draw a lot of my acting classes. We are fortunate on the show to have just an unbelievable ensemble cast of actors who I hope, if the show continues, we'll get a chance to even do more.
In our conversation, Michael reflects on how the film business has changed in the 50 plus years he's been in it.
I guess the other big change that's happened is the change to digital from celluloid. You're not waiting for the camera. The camera's ready and waiting for you.
Michael also talks to me about being mentored by Carl Malden early in his career and what he's still learning today from his Kominsky Method co-star, Alan Arkin. Let's get to it. Michael, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I did realize today that I'm getting a little squirrely with the lockdown. You know, we're 3.5 months. Yeah, we started beginning of March, so we're over 3.5 months. And I realized my response of frustration today was shaded a little bit by 3.5 months of lockdown. So.
Yeah, it's been a lot. How have you been spending your days? Have you come up with a routine for yourself?
Yes, I have. I've managed to milk the New York Times and LA Times for about 2.5 hours in the morning. It can easily, you know, take me 2.5 hours to get through them, get a nice little workout, a nice lunch, maybe a little nap after lunch if we want, take care of a couple of things, which sort of is my time, and then it's the evening. I'm a news junkie, right? I love current events and I love news. And I sort of had made a promise to myself to kind of stay away from it and everything. And then as we got into this, I said, who the hell are you kidding? This is the biggest issue in your 75-year life, what's happening right now. So I became a stone-cold junkie. I break it up a little bit now, the last month and a half, but I try to just check the news around midday and then in the evening. But I watch a lot of news.
What's your go-to source network?
I go CNN, MSNBC, and the BBC.
Okay.
And then I'll check in with Fox once in a while, and I'll check in with the other One in America and the other one, just, you know. But, you know, this is taking over the world's medium. I mean, you watch the BBC and it's almost like watching our news. It's just, it's a pretty crazy time. Where are you from, Yon? Are you from L.A. or where are you from?
I am from L.A., born and raised.
There you go.
Yeah. So it has been hard. Like, I don't live close to my mom, who's like in Pico Rivera, close to Whittier. So it's been like hard. I'm not like too close to family. And, you know, I cherish the technology that we have that makes it easier, but it's also, you know, it can be a little exhausting getting on the Zoom calls. And I don't know, it's been an adjustment for sure.
I'm sure. Oh, yeah, I'm sure you're working out. Yeah, we're about to come out to L.A., bringing my son and Catherine to see my stepmother, Anne, who, you know, it's been quite a year. She lost her husband. I lost dad in February and haven't really been able to get out to see her since then. It's been a little lonely for her, so. We're all getting out there to see her now.
That'll be a special time.
Yeah. She's doing well, but it'll be great. But you guys are having trouble out in L.A. now. I mean, we're, you know, after New York, now Mr. Cuomo's preening around like a peacock, as well as he should. And the rest of us is, we're like at new lows here.
Are you somebody that is sort of living in fear? Are you very cautious about your movements and, you know, when you go outside and what precautions you take, or how have you been sort of navigating this?
Well, I mean, looking at the statistics, for anybody close to my age, this is not a virus that you want to catch. So yeah, we're looking. We live outside of the city, about a half an hour. So we got little grounds around us. A nice walking trail, kind of a flat trail that was built over an aqueduct system that kind of connected all of these kind of river towns together. We live in one of the river towns along the Hudson River. And so it's a good walk, and keep moving. I do fine with a mask on. I don't do well with a mask and sunglasses. They fog up so fast.
Yes, that's the constant struggle. Well, I know you mentioned that you're watching a lot of news, but are you watching any TV? I'm so desperate to know what Michael Douglas watches TV wise.
I'm catching up with all the episodes of Black Mirror, which I've seen just a little bit, but somebody reminded me, and I went back and just really impressed with how good that is. And I'm enjoying, I like the first year of Fauda, but I don't watch a lot. I don't go to a lot of movies. I do, Academy time with the awards and stuff. I love making movies. I love the process, but I don't dwell on them. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting about television. I try to see a little bit of the streaming. I have no idea how people are able to see the amount of stuff that they do. There's so much streaming stuff out there. So I jump around a little bit, but right now I'm enjoying Black Mirror.
That's nice. Well, let's talk about the Kominsky method. I mean, the show is billed as a comedy, but given its subject matter, it often delves into some serious material. And in season two, your character, Sandy Kominsky, learns he has lung cancer and he doesn't want to tell people. And then obviously it turns out everyone finds out. And you've talked about how you felt your own health scare would forever tarnish you in the industry's eyes. Did you find a deeper connection with the character with this storyline? Like, could you understand his fears and concerns and internal wheel spinning about what was happening to his body?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the short answer is yes. I went through the whole kit and caboodle as far as the chemo. So it was one of those moments that was easier to relate to. Yeah, it was a lot of health issues for old Sandy, second season.
Has showcasing the realities of what men face as they age provided some catharsis for you?
That's a good question. I don't think so. It's sort of like when I got, hit with my cancer, I just kept kind of let's just get through this, the whole sequence of events in terms of the chemo and the radiation, and it's all going to be okay. And then we'll worry. We still got a problem. It's not in remission. And so I certainly take that attitude with Sandy, who's hopefully not going to dwell on this, but just keep on going forward. But it's one of the aspects that I enjoy about playing a character that's my age. The prostate issue is one thing. Cancer, of course, is a little serious. And I admire Chuck Lorre so much as he racks his brains to find some humor out of all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this series was the first time you worked with your co-star, Alan Arkin. Two seasons in, how would you describe his work ethic, and have you learned anything from him during this time?
Well, I've tried to learn from him. I mean, there's certain things, because one of the joys about doing the Kominsky method for a guy that doesn't do a lot of comedy was at this point in your life, learning a little more about timing, learning a little bit more about delivery. So I watch Alan a lot. God knows from his experience at Second City and all of that. But I have not mastered his effortlessness, which seems to be part of the equation. I mean, delivery is really interesting. I mean, the delivery in terms of how you get a laugh and what's funny and what's not. So I shadow him closely on the sets, and sort of watching how he does it. I can't say that I'm overly successful in repeating his ability, but it's a treat. It's always nice, especially with somebody who I'd never known before. I didn't know Alan before. I know God knows his work, big fan, but never had worked for him before. And there's that wonderful moment, Yvonne, where you kind of settled in early in the year. Actually, it was like our first scene together in Musso Franks, one of our first scenes, when you just know this is going to be good. This is really going to be good, where your rhythms kind of match up together. There's a comfort factor. He has such a great shit detector, Alan, you know, about smelling truthfulness and honesty that I find really helpful. So it's been a real treat.
What's it like between takes with the two of you?
He normally, God bless him, has his wife with him, who he loves adoringly, and Suzanne, and he gets off to see her a lot. I tend to go back. I'm not a big social guy. You kind of pace yourself. You know, we're all getting, Alan's a few years older than I am. So it's not as if you got a lot of time for small talk and this and that. You got to pace yourself. It's long days. But we share jazz. I love jazz. So does Alan. And he likes to fetch. He loves to fetch, and I like to listen. It's a match made in heaven. You know?
Well, the show brings in guest stars often, and sometimes they're guest stars that you know well, like Danny DeVito. And this season, we see Kathleen Turner, your co-star in Romancing the Stone, as one of your ex-wives. How is it to invite your friends into this world? And did you get much time with Kathleen? Because from what I remember, it was mostly a phone call conversation.
No, it was. No, I knocked on her door when she came in, give her a hug and tell her how grateful and happy I was that she was doing it. But it's always, almost always easier with people that you know, with friends. You know, that's why with Kathleen, I had the benefit of doing, three movies together. And you understand why people like Hepburn and Tracy do pictures together. You get rid of all that formal shaking hands and trying to get to know each other. There's a comfort factor which just allows you to eliminate all of that. So I was very excited when she said it. I thought it would be perfect. You can kind of, when she did it, and who knows what the future holds. But I like the kind of the War of the Roses kind of animosity between the two, and I can an ex-wife, and I think there's a lot of chance for some humor that we do very well, dumping on each other. We do a very, very good job. So she was wonderful. Jane Seymour came in for Alan, did a lovely job. Bob Odenkirk, I'm just such a fan of his, and that was all Chuck's work in Bob. So that worked out very well. And then, of course, Paul Reiser, who is, he's funny, man. He's funny. Just a joy to work with. And so I kind of feels like people, see the show and they like the level of quality that, Alan and I and the rest of the cast are bringing, and they want to come in and do a guest shot, which is flattering. So it's been a nice group. And I love this format, the kind of a half hour show. It's over in a week. Then you got a new episode, new director. New people. It's been a long time since I did The Streets of San Francisco, back almost 50 years ago, just about. And there, too, I shared with Carl Malden, who's truly my mentor. And sometimes I must think it's 50 years later. But when I look at Alan and I think of Carl and how my career has been bookended by these two great talents that have that influenced me so much.
Well, I was going to ask you about that time, like going back a little bit of what it was like to be mentored by Carl Malden.
He was spectacular. He had, first of all, Carl originally came from Gary, Indiana, the steel mills. He had a tremendous sense of work ethic, of how valuable this job was. And so we used to, between scenes, would work on the next week's script, the next episode, just running lines and this and that. And he set up a quality, a level of quality, so that when guest stars came up or directors, they were on their best footing. They said, hey, look out, those two guys, you know, they got their stuff together. They're ready to go. And the writers used to hate us because the scripts are like 6 to 8 pages longer, only because we picked up our cues, because we rehearsed a lot and we picked up our cues and we're ready to go. So Carl, you know, just taught me so much about our work ethic, taught me so much about listening. And was just very, very fortunate and grateful. And also in those days, being the second banana in those cop shows and everything else, you normally were like 2 feet back in soft focus, you know, and the lead of the show, Carl, was in front. Carl brought me on up there. Come on up, buddy boy. Stand next to me and this and that. So it was a great opportunity. And I understand why so many actors like Marlon Brando wanted to work with Carl, because he gave me the core of realizing how important it was to make other actors good. In other words, you want everybody to be as good as they can. And that involves when your other actors, when you are off camera and another actor is doing his close-up, give as much as you can to him. Don't just dismiss it because you're off camera. And so he set a level of quality, a level of trying to make the whole show work, not just worried about your character, but to try to make everybody else as effective as possible. This lasted me my entire career.
Well, I mean, your character Sandy is somebody trying to give tools to the next generation of actors. He is somebody who was once a successful actor who is now working as an acting coach in Hollywood. And he offers some, you know, profound lessons this season about finding the truth in a performance. And there's that moment where you perform a scene from Doubt. How do you feel when you're in the role of acting coach on the show?
It's fun. I draw a lot of my acting classes. We are fortunate on the show to have just an unbelievable ensemble cast of actors who I hope, if the show continues, we'll get a chance to even do more, you know, and get some more characters and more ability, more time. But I enjoy it. I enjoy my studio, enjoy my office. I love working with Sarah, Mindy, my daughter. It feels complete. It feels very comfortable and complete.
Well, I did want to get some more anecdotes from you about your schooling through Wynn and like how that gave you confidence as an actor. Because I think you've said before that you battled crippling stage fright. So how did you sort of overcome that?
Well, I overcame that in two ways, by doing The Streets of San Francisco, where I did 104 episodes, 104 hours, over 4 years, 6 days a week. When you know you're going to get up to bat again and again and again, no matter how terrified you are, and no matter how much those old-time cameras look like your dentist x-ray machines, you know, staring at you, you just finally get better. you finally sort of relax and you listen because you've been up to bat enough times. And then I also had something happen. I remember somebody early in my career said to me, you know, the camera can always tell when you're lying. And I took that to heart. Ooh, the camera can tell when I'm lying. And I got into this sort of method period there for a while. Everything was painful, and I was acting out of real rage or almost pain. And then it was actually really later. I think it was close like to Fatal Attraction, 85, you know, maybe 10, 15 years later. And I was preparing for Fatal Attraction. And I was looking and I said, okay, he's a lawyer. Okay, yeah, well, I could be a lawyer. He lives in New York. Well, I live in New York. He could have, you know, might have been an adulterer. Yeah, you know, it's possible. And then I realized, well, wait a minute. You know, we're talking about building a character. I mean, this is a lot me. I mean, a lot of this is exposing yourself. So all of a sudden I realized that also that acting is really lying. That's all it is. It's pretending to be somebody else. And you just have to be a great liar to convince somebody. And once I made that kind of adjustment, it just gave me the freedom to do much more. Because, of course, you know, we all tell white lies, and of course we are actors and try to make them convincing. And that was what allowed me then sort of set my own sense of what's truth. And my truth was lying.
This episode is brought to you by I Know This Much Is True on HBO. I Know This Much Is True follows Dominic Birdsey as he struggles to care for his twin brother Thomas while discovering the truth about his own family history. Based on the best-selling novel by Wally Lamb, the limited series is written and directed by Derek Cianfrance and stars Mark Ruffalo. The Hollywood Reporter hails the series' tremendous performances, and Decider considers the series a stunning work of art. I Know This Much Is True is eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories.
Well, you've come from a family of actors, and, like, you know, Tony Curtis and Frank Sinatra were guests at your house all the time. How did being witness to all that, seeing the way they conducted themselves, what their insecurities were, how did seeing all that prepare you for a lifetime in the industry?
Well, I think that's the biggest advantage of being second generation, is that you were able to, even as a young guy, as a kid, you were able to see your father with his friends that are all in the business, and you see their insecurities. You see their foibles. You see them as real people, you know, laughing and joking. And it takes, you know, a lot of that mystery away, and also some of the magic, quite honestly, because you kind of see it as a business rather than wide-eyed from coming from Ohio, coming out to California with all your dreams. You've seen the rejection that your family has faced, that you've seen their failures as well as their successes. Because one thing you learn is you work just as hard on your failures as you do on your successes. And I do miss the time when I was growing up with, and it's true, both Sinatra, Tony Curtis, Greg Peck, they were all really close, Danny Kaye, close friends of my dad's and my stepmother's, and we over there a lot. But it was a much closer community. You know, everything has spread out so much more, you know, and more distances. And I guess the other big change that's happened is the change to digital from celluloid. Mm-hmm. And that's been a tremendous aid, I think, for actors. Whereas before, you would have these 1,000-foot magazine reels, which is how long you could shoot for. Everything had to be with it queued up and edited correctly, and, you know, 2:54, take one. And now with the digital, you just run and run and run. So you can do a couple of takes, but you can do a pickup and everything else. And it gives you a much better momentum and energy for actors, because you're not waiting for the camera. The camera's ready and waiting for you.
Sandy is someone whose life just didn't turn out the way he anticipated. Was there a kind of stardom or a type of career you were chasing when you became an actor? And when did you reach sort of your own satisfaction with it?
Well, I didn't do any acting when I was younger in school until I was in college. And then really I started acting because I didn't know what else to do and I had to have a major. And so I took theater and slowly started acting, and I wasn't good. I really worked. I worked hard at it, and then I was fortunate enough to get the. I did a couple of movies, didn't work out, then got the series. And it really again wasn't. I don't think until the year of Fatal Attraction and Wall Street. I was like 85, where because the weird thing that happened is that because I was in television series, even though I won an Oscar for producing, I was still a television actor. So as I began my feature film career as a producer, there were still a lot of studios where I was not approved as an actor for movies that I was producing. So for instance, there was a movie called Starman, which I developed. And Jeff Bridges did the picture because I was not approved as a director. He got nominated for an Academy Award. Thank you very much. I was too early on with a couple of other pictures. I was lucky to get Romancing the Stone because the other actors, the stars, had passed on it. So the point is that one of the beauties that's happened now with streaming is it's allowed people from film to come into the television-sized box to work with people in television. It's broken down that barrier. So rather than us being on separate tracks, we all merge and come together. But for me, my sense of having success wasn't really till about 85 when I felt in a large part that I had stepped out of the shadow of my dad. I felt my dad's shadow over me pretty much before then. People saying, oh, you look just like your dad. Oh, that's just like what your dad would do. And, you know, this is one of the few careers where if you're following your father in a business, you better be pretty different.
What were your discussions like with your father about that? Did you feel any pressure from him? Was it all just internal pressure you felt?
Yeah. No, it was all internal. He was wonderful. I mean, as busy as he was, Dad had come to most of my early productions in college at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He also was one of the first people when he saw my messenger speech, A Much Ado About Nothing, to say, son, you're terrible. Jesus. You are really, he felt very relieved. I think they didn't have to worry about me becoming an actor based on how bad I was. But that's all I needed to hear. Because I probably then worked harder than that than anything. All you need to do is try to prove your dad wrong, you know, when you're 19 years old. And so that's the way it went.
Which character that you've played would you say has taught you the most about yourself? There's a lot to choose from.
Wow. I'd be a hard one. I'll tell you one. The only reason I'm mentioning it because we're dealing with the loss of Joel Schumacher, who directed Falling Down. So I guess I have a strong memory today of Joel, who I admired a lot, on a wonderful little movie, Falling Down, that's ended up having a long life. People enjoy it. You know, there's a piece of you. You try to. Unless it's, you know, big characterizations like Liberace, you know, you always have a piece of you in most every part that you do. And then it's really a question of what's well written. Pictures like the American president, you know, was really well written. And there's others. I liked a little picture called Wonder Boys, had a good cast. So I think there's a part of you in everything. I mean, I'm in that gray area. You know, I've talked about it a lot. I like that gray area, which is not necessarily good or bad. You try to make the right decision, but there's a little element of larceny in all of us. So you try to do what's right. And I like that moral struggle. I enjoy that.
Well, there are still so many unknowns in Hollywood right now, production-wise. And I think it's fair to say, no one has ever experienced something like this, and I'm sure it's a first for you in your career. Do you worry about when you'll next be on a set?
No. I mean, I worry about a lot of other things. I mean, I worry about our country. I never thought I'd be worrying about our democracy, but I really am. I'm worried and amazed at the vulnerability at the richest, most powerful country in the history of mankind, and how vulnerable we are. So it'll be when it's going to be, but, you know, this COVID-19 has thrown a lot of curves to us, and there's a lot of unanswered questions. And, you know, one of them still is no one's completely made it clear to me how our country has failed so ultimately compared to any other country in the world. How have we done so poorly? But as far as next time I'm getting to work, it'll be whenever it's safe. I'm fine. I mean, I think we've all found out and explored a lot of situations with this time, this downtime. It's been a wonderful time for my family, for my wife, and our kids have been here. So I really have realized how rare it's going to be. You know, my kids are out of the house now in terms of in school or away. And my oldest son's Cameron's acting. But to be able to spend time like this together is such a unique quality. So I try to really cherish that in lieu of the epidemic. And you know, we'll go whenever they are. There, people are smarter than I am or trying to work it out. You know, what's the best way? And I guess this is making me think, I'm not really a religious guy, but I was trying to discover, you know, who worships Mother Nature? Because I'm beginning to think that Mother Nature is, you know, is my goddess. Looking into the Gaia religion, because between between this pandemic and the climate and our seas and our heat and this and that, I think she's really telling us that she's not too happy with what's going on.
So. Yeah. It's something we all need to be more mindful of and reflect on during this time, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, before I get to my final question, I have one of my own that I think viewers of the Kominsky Method, they'll get the reference. Michael, when was the last time you had Cheetos?
When I was on the set. They're dangerous.
They really are. Well, our final question comes from our previous guest, Davine Joy Randolph from High Fidelity.
My question is, due to the climate, a movie like Falling Down is very topical even now. When you did Falling Down, did you know the impact this movie would have? What was that experience like filming and creating that iconic character?
No, I mean, the script... Ebby Rose Smith wrote the script, and it really struck home to me. Even though they were developing at the time as a so-called cable movie, but you know, it was after the Vietnam War, and all of a sudden, and I know it's hard for a lot of people to realize because you've been in LA your whole life, but besides the film industry, Los Angeles was also led in the defense industry. And so I, clearly understood, a very patriotic guy working in the defense industry. And for a country that had been so successful, the war was over and they pink slipped. All these guys working there patriotically to defend our country. I saw the nucleus of that, of somebody boiling over with the rage of what's wrong with this picture. Or here I am as the American and all the things that have gone wrong and taking off on a racist attack in a couple of places. But I did not know at the time, although I did think it was hitting a zeitgeist, a moment. And I do like that picture a lot.
Wow. Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time. It was a real pleasure getting to speak with you.
Thank you, Yvonne. Thanks so much for your help. And I enjoyed it. And stay healthy.
You too.
Bye-bye.
That's it for the 30th episode of Can't Stop Watching. I'm your host, Yvonne Villarreal. Our producer is Paige Heimson, and our executive producer is Abby Fentress-Swanson. Our engineer is Mike Heflin, and a special shout-out to Elena Howe for booking the guests for this podcast. And thanks to all of you for listening. After this episode, we're going to take a quick break from Can't Stop Watching. But we'll be back with another set of interviews next month after the Emmy nominations are announced. So stay tuned. If you like our podcast, subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple. Special thanks to Julia Turner, Matt Brennan, and Clint Shaw. We hope you're enjoying this podcast created by the journalists at the LA Times. Right now, access to facts has never been more important, and the Times is in the business of reporting them. Stay connected and subscribe, because your subscription supports the production of podcasts like this one and our award-winning journalism. Visit latimes.com/supportlatimes to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and see you next month.